Hey, everybody, the Greg Kelly Podcast. And hey, do you follow me on Twitter? And here's the thing, I want to tell you that there is a picture on my Twitter homepage. I'm in uniform, not uniform, I'm wearing military equipment, camouflaged. I'm standing in the desert. The desert is Iraq, and there are tanks behind me. And there is a soldier to my right. I'm not wearing a helmet. He is wearing a helmet. And that soldier is Eric Wesley. At the time, he was a major in the United States Army, 2003. This is during the invasion of Iraq. I got to know him. I had only known him about 2 months when this picture was taken, but we've become and we're very good friends. He went on to become a 3-star general, and he's an all-around really great guy. He's one of those people I've grown closer to over the years, in part because of my politics. I've lost some friends, I haven't lost those friends, but I'm not talking to them as much as I used to, and that's very sad for me. But the divisions that the country is experiencing right now, it manifests in your own life, and that's tough. But anyway, I am so thrilled that Eric remains a great friend, and he is a great American, truly, and a great patriot, man of faith, excellence, great expertise. And he's done so many things, from executive officer of a brigade during an invasion to 3-star general to key national security post in the Obama administration. He was a military officer. He was there in a nonpartisan capacity, detailed from the Pentagon. So this is only one part of our conversation. There are some things that I wanted to know about Eric that I didn't know, and some things I wanted you to know. So this is a part one, I think, of what will be ultimately a 3-part conversation. I want you to have an idea of what it's like to be in the Army, who's in the Army, what is military life like, and we talk about all of that. My conversation with my good friend, Eric Wesley. Eric Wesley, General Eric Wesley, thanks for being with us. How are you?
Good, Greg. Thanks for having me today. Good to talk to you.
So a lieutenant general is a 3-star general, right?
That's correct. And for those that might not know, there's 4 levels in the military, 1, 2, 3, and 4-star.
How many people get to be a general out of like everybody in the Army? You start out with how many, and how many actually make it to general?
You know, I probably have to think about the statistics, but I'll tell you this: it's a million man force in any given time. It's legislated they can't have no more than 300 generals on active duty out of that million man force. So it's a pretty small percentage from start when you're a second lieutenant to the time you become a general officer.
And so it's like it's a big deal. And is it all it's cracked up to be? Or is it like, let me go back. Was your goal when you entered the Army, like, I want to be a general someday?
No, not at all. In fact, I wasn't sure that I would be around more than 5 years. What I found was I fell in love with being on a military team, and I fell in love with the idea of leadership. I would be hesitant to affiliate with someone who plans to be a general when they're a second lieutenant. There are a few that have and achieved it, but I think that might reflect an ambition that's a little bit out of balance. I wasn't sure I would have had the opportunity to be a battalion commander and just happened to be blessed to stay as long as we did.
Well, yeah, that makes sense. Somebody who joins a company and wants to be the CEO someday, like by definition, is pretty obnoxious.
Yeah, it's a little overly ambitious, I think.
But right? You went to the elite academy, you know, the future where that future generals often come from, West Point. Wait, before we get to that, where did you grow up?
I grew up, in fact, I'm sitting on the street I grew up on in Yorba Linda, California. I was in a community, Orange County, that doesn't have a lot of military background, and so wasn't exposed to a lot of military people. I just happened to learn about the military through my father, who suggested the academies as a way to be educated.
Was he military?
He was enlisted in the Navy, but what he recognized when he was in the Navy was the opportunity of people from around America, of all social backgrounds, all economic backgrounds, who had the opportunity to compete to go to an academy. He saw academy grads in the Navy when he was enlisted, and recognized the virtues of the education and opportunities that come with it. So he said, "Hey, Eric, take a look at this. And, you know, if you go back to that era, I graduated from high school in 1982, and I oftentimes call myself a Reagan baby. You know, I had this unique, spontaneous patriotism that was inside of me. And so I identified with it very quickly and sought to attend."
What did he do for a living? Other than
He was brilliant. And he used his time in the Navy to leverage the GI Bill to go to school. And he was a physics major in college, became an antenna engineer and a radar engineer, and ultimately worked for defense contractors to develop a lot of the technology we used in the 1980s as we built out the force that Ronald Reagan really resourced in the 1980s.
And by the way, Yorba Linda is, that's Richard Nixon's hometown, right?
In fact, it is. He was born here in Yorba Linda. The grade school that I went to was called Richard Nixon Elementary School because it was on the site he was born. And later, after Richard Nixon passed and they developed the library there, they raised the school. And the library you go to today for Richard Nixon is on the site where I went to grade school.
Oh, no kidding. All right. Somehow when I've been to that library, I thought it was the original location. So they moved it there.
No. The library is at the original location, but they destroyed a grade school, the one I attended, in order to build the library itself.
Right. I guess the house where he... The
house was... that's the original location.
That's the original location, too. All right. It's quite a place. So you start thinking about the academy, and where else did you apply to college?
I'm a little embarrassed to tell you that that's where I applied. I didn't have a backup plan, Greg. And some would say that's probably not wise. I had considered going to other schools in California and maybe leveraging ROTC, but I threw all my eggs in that basket. And fortunately, it worked out for me. Otherwise, I might have gone to maybe a junior college had I not been accepted.
So you have to get nominated by a member of Congress or a senator or somebody important in the federal government who nominated you.
I got a nomination from Congressman Bill Dannemeyer. He was the congressman from the 39th district here in California, and was one of several that got a nomination here. In fact, you'll recognize another name from Orange County that got a nomination at the same time, a gentleman by the name of Mike Pompeo. So we start talking about West Point, we can talk about the nature of its production of leaders, but both of us came from the same community here. Bill Dannemeyer was the congressman.
And all right, so you got to get nominated, and that getting nominated is not the same as getting in. You still have to get in, right?
That's correct. And you know, it's an interesting mechanism, Craig, because remember I said that people that go to the academies come from all social backgrounds, all economic backgrounds from across the country. It's one of the most charming aspects of going to a graduation. You see people from all over, all different walks of life, farmers, agrarian, inner city. And these families come to this amazing institution with great history. And oftentimes these families, when they get there for graduation, is the first time they've ever been there. And they're in awe that their son or daughter had the opportunity to, because I came from a family that wouldn't necessarily have had the resources to go to a Harvard or a Stanford or a Georgetown. And this is an opportunity, right? So how do we ensure that that opportunity occurs? What the law specifies that congressmen have X amount of nominations that they can have in at the academy at any given time. And they do interview processes within their local communities to ensure there's a well-balanced draw from across the United States to go into the academy. So you're right. You get first step is to get a nomination from a congressman or senator. And then there's a very few vice presidential nominations that exist also. Then once you get nominated, you have to be accepted by the institution itself to make sure you've got the right academic, athletic, leadership background to be accepted.
You know, it's interesting that I've never heard a whiff of complaint about the system nominating people for the academy, students for the academy. It's not, no patronage seems to be involved. You don't hear about political favors. I mean, this has been going on for over a century, two centuries, and I've just never heard that.
Isn't that an interesting point? I've never heard it say it like you just said it. I know that it has the potential to read as a policy that could be rife with patronage. But what I've witnessed in not only my time when I went through the application process, but also as a leader in the military and being engaged in different congressional districts, these congressmen take it very seriously, and it goes on both sides of the aisle. I have not come across. I imagine it occurred maybe decades or in the last century, but I have seen no case where you don't have a congressman's office take that responsibility very seriously. I happened to be, when I was interviewed to get the nomination, I didn't even talk to the congressman. There was a board of people that reviewed files, and then you had to go sit down. And there was a judge, there was a fire chief, there was a police chief, there was a mayor, and they would ask very penetrating and hard questions and then make recommendations to the congressman.
So, all right, a couple of things about West Point. Number one, you're paid to be there, right? You're on salary of some kind.
There is a stipend. It's not a profit making one, but it helps to pay for expenses, books, et cetera. And there's a marginal amount that you get at the end of the month. But what is key, my parents ultimately were alleviated of, a significant burden of college education. They paid for my flight home when I had time off. But other than that, everything is funded and paid for.
And there's an obligation. You take that money. Well, let me put it this way. If you decide, you're a junior and you want to quit, you're in your third year at West Point, and you say, this is not for me. Are you obligated to pay that money back, or because they've just given you 3 years of free education? What happens then?
Yeah, there's any number of gradients that, that depending on what happens. The day you enter your junior year, the commitment is solidified. You can leave the first 2 years at no penalty. I've seen varying degrees of reconciliation when somebody leaves after their junior year. Sometimes you can be forced to enlist in the Army in order to pay back a certain amount of time. Sometimes you can be billed for that if the grievance is so bad that they might not want you enlisted in the Army. So there's varying ways to compensate the government if you leave after your sophomore year.
So West Point, by the way, is one of the most beautiful locations on earth. I just find it to be, you were saying earlier, it is a magnificent place on the Hudson River. It's only about 45 minutes without traffic from New York City. It's just awe-inspiring.
Yeah. It sells itself. I didn't have the opportunity to go there before I applied, but when you walk onto those grounds, you've seen it. It's awesome. And there's great history there. Many people might not know that it was this, George Washington declared it as the one strategic outpost that was critical to achieving a victory in the Revolutionary War. And the reason is because the Hudson River there, it was a primary channel. And it just so happens right at West Point, it does a dogleg or a significant S curve. And it was a place to defend that portion of this new fledgling country from British attack, because the British ships had to make that really tough S turn and it made them vulnerable.
Yeah, basically, it's so skinny that you could put the river is so skinny you could put a chain across it, which is what they did. You could block the passing.
That's right. And the chain was an obstacle to slow down the ships, in which case you could shoot on them.
Oh, that part I didn't realize. I thought it just does. Slow them down so you can shoot at them. So, look, West Point, you get there. Oh, by the way, they yell and scream at you, right? I mean, you show up for college. Most people, there's freshman week. There's an ice cream social. Everybody's nice. they bring in a band. Sometimes it's a pretty decent band and all kinds of things. And there's keg parties. you guys are basically being yelled at and screamed at. It's like boot camp, right?
It's like basic training or boot camp. And, you know, before we go further, let me, you know, one, the reason West Point and the academies are so powerful, and I'm obviously biased towards West Point, is it is a leadership factory. And in order to build a leadership factory, number one, and two, to be able to build teams, the military has been doing this for a long time. And there's a certain aspect when you do draw people from across society is you've got a baseline context. You have to baseline who we are. You have to baseline the purpose of the military and what you are as a team member. And that can be a bit intimidating upon arrival to any basic training, boot camp, cadet basic training environment. And it's humbling and it's intimidating. But what we're doing is we're breaking down some maybe inappropriate perspectives and building it back up towards one that is a single team for the United States military.
You know, it's interesting though. It's a leadership factory and nobody knows leadership like the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, but a lot of those techniques would be illegal to bring into the workplace. Now, some are vaunted and admirable, and yes, you can bring them in, but you know, the yelling, the screaming, the shouting, the punishment, the this, the that, you can't do anything like that. You can't look at anybody. And I do wonder, you know, because look, I have some of those tendencies, to be honest. You know, what I learned in the Marine Corps.
You're a screamer, Greg?
Not quite a screamer, but you know what I mean. Like, there are some, you rule by intimidation and pointing the finger at somebody. And I guess part of it is, you know, in the Army, you just can't quit. You just can't. That's one of the reasons why, I think, and we can intellectualize it, but one of the reasons why they're screaming and shouting. In the real world, if you do that, people will just, number one, they'll go to HR, or number two, they'll quit, which is totally a reasonable response. You can't do that in the Army. And I wonder, go ahead.
You can't do that. But the other thing is you kind of learn to be a bit resilient. And when you're more resilient, it's not just about you. And so you can absorb maybe, you know, a comment from your boss, a comment from your drill sergeant, with a little greater resilience for the purpose of really achieving what it is that you want to achieve and not being distracted by your feelings getting hurt.
Can I ask you this, though? Is that a justification that came up later? Like, you know, this was such a tradition. This was so ingrained. You know, you showed up, you yelled. Did the people who started that a long time ago, and wherever the hell that was, in Mongolia, I don't know, Peloponnesian, who knows. But that the idea was, you know, you're in, you're here by force, you can't leave, you're ours, so we're going to abuse you a little bit. I mean, because what you just said makes sense, but I wonder if that's an argument, if that's a rationale that came up later.
I wonder. I have not studied it to that depth. I think there's a little bit of both. And when you join any institution, whether you join a football team or fraternity, there's a rite of passage that for, you know, it's human behavior, I think. And I think it goes back to tribal behaviors. And so I would imagine you are right that there is some rationalization that came afterwards. But I would argue that although that may have been the origins of these kinds of human behaviors, the fact that it continued might be an indicator that it had a certain effect. And as for me personally, I knew that when I went through events like that, and then maybe even one parallel to that, when I went to Ranger School, I knew when I got out of those programs or those events that there was nothing that the world was going to bring my way that I couldn't handle because I'd already been through something harder. So it's a significant confidence builder too, I think.
Yeah. So what was that first year like? They call it the plebe year, right?
That's right. And, you know, one thing that people might not realize, I call it a leadership factory. Every single thing we do at West Point, to include that first plebe year, is about developing a soldier and a leader. And there is very little, if any, social partying activity that goes on that doesn't have a very specific purpose, and your time is managed from morning till night by the minute, not entirely by the institution, partly forced on you based on your obligations, because you're up in the morning, you're doing some kind of athletic program, you're going to academic programs 6 days a week. The amount of work that they give you is specifically designed to far exceed what you could ever achieve. So you got to understand time management. So you're really on the clock the entire time. And it's about learning how to manage a lot of different problems that you won't be able to achieve entirely well. And therefore, you have to prioritize. So that first year was about a whole new life. I wasn't in California surfing, you know, in the afternoon or on the weekends. I was, you know, when I was in high school, I was blessed to be able to do well academically. It was the first time in my life where I had to really come to grips with work and prioritization, because I was at risk of not, you know, passing my classes.
So,
and that's good.
What did you major in?
I was, ironically, at the Land Force Academy, I was an aerospace major. My father was an engineer, and so he was important, significantly important in my life. And so when, you know, when you're a kid and you have a good relationship with your father, you kind of tend to identify with him as the approved solution. And so growing up, it was my view that, you know, real men are engineers, right? And so I was an aerospace major throughout the academy.
And can you major in like English literature if you want to at one of these places?
Oh, golly. Yeah, it's a pretty broad liberal education. There's a lot of opportunities. You know, maybe the fine arts is one that you can't do at the academy. But other than that, most majors that you would get out of a liberal educating university would be reflected there.
And it gets a little bit easier after freshman year, right? I mean, they start to treat you better, and you have more authority and that kind of thing. And is it somewhat like a normal college existence?
Each year you're there, you get a little more freedom and a little more authority, and have leadership positions as you go up. And then when you become a senior, you are the leadership of that institution. So it does get better for two reasons. One, you're given more freedoms. Two, your muscle memory improves, right? And with the human condition is amazing, because you start to learn to adapt to these really difficult constraints, and you get better and better at it. It doesn't ever become, my experience when I was there, it doesn't ever become like a normal university. There was, when I was senior at West Point, there was only one night where you really could get together with friends and go out. It would be Saturday night. But you know, you're limited because you're starting your classes the next day and you're getting right back into it.
So, I heard that you guys, there's all kinds of interesting summers activities. You can go, to Europe and work with, you know, NATO. You can do all kinds of interesting things, during the summers, and maybe even take, what would you say was the most interesting, unique experience you had, whether it was during the summer or during the school, or just some sort of very unique, I didn't know that you could do something like that at West Point.
First of all, I would tell you, it's not that you can do these things. You must do these things. That people might not realize that, you know, you don't get the summer off. So every summer you're committed to a certain military training activity. There's no academics that go on during the summer. The summers are for the purpose of starting to inculcate the military training in the field, right? So you'd have about 2 weeks off, and then you'd move into some form of military training. One of the one that fascinated me the most was the summer between my sophomore and junior year. And that's the summer we send cadets out to the regular Army, in the case of West Point. And what we really did is I was sent down to Fort Hood, Texas as a cadet and given a platoon to lead as if I was a lieutenant. So you are really given a foreshadowing. You fast forward 2 years ahead what you're going to experience your first day on the job as a lieutenant leading 15 to 30 men. So that was a fascinating experience, because I was thrust into the actual military environment as a leader. The second thing that summer, though, which you might not know, I know you're a Harrier pilot by trade. There's a cadet program where you can go to flight school. So I went down to Fort Rucker and for 6 weeks flew rotary wing aircraft in an initial intro program to flight school.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Actually, maybe vaguely, you told me that about a long. Okay, so did you get to solo in a helicopter? How much did you learn?
The last week is about soloing in the helicopter. And it's really amazing when you think that in 6 week period, you know, you're having cadets up there flying an aircraft.
Wait a second. You soloed in a helicopter when you were.
Really? Not solo the way you're describing it. In order to pass, there's an instructor pilot with you, but in order to pass, you have to bring it up to a hover, do a cycle in the airspace, bring it in all on your own in order to complete the course. And so that was the pinnacle of the training period.
That's so incredible. What kind of and I'm sorry, that was between sophomore and junior year?
Yeah, and that was a TH-55 helicopter. People would recognize the old bubble front police helicopters, and that's the way they used to do the initial training for our rotary wing pilots.
Yeah, like the one in MASH, I think, too, right?
Yeah, similar to that.
That is so cool. Did you think, hey, maybe I want to be a pilot? Because obviously there are a lot of pilots. A lot of them are warrant officers. Did you think about aviation after that?
I did. So that's why I took the course. And it was actually profound for me. You know, any young kid has always thought about flying, right? And so I thought that might be a pathway for me. I found I chose not to. After I went to flight school, Greg, I decided to pursue a different path. And that was to be a maneuver commander as an armor officer. Why? Why did I do that? For two reasons. One was I found my perception was that an aviator doesn't get quite the opportunity to lead large groups of men in order to achieve an outcome. It, you know, being a pilot is an individual skill that doesn't give you quite the experience to lead as maybe an infantryman or an armor officer. The second reason, and if I could be a little humble here, I didn't think I was that good. and there is that, you know, there is a certain talent to be a good pilot. And rotary wing is fundamentally different than fixed wing because there's so many different variables you're controlling. And, you know, I thought, I don't want to get in the game of getting someone killed.
Yeah.
And namely myself. And so I did it, but I didn't think I had the right talent to be really good at it, which is what you want to do, right? You want to pursue that which you can really achieve. And so I decided to become a ground maneuver commander.
Well, I'm looking now at the TH-55. You're a brave man just for getting in this thing. the helicopter from MASH looks like a 747 compared to this thing. This is...
I see you're doing a Google search there. It's pretty small aircraft.
You can make this in your backyard, but that's still incredibly impressive that you get to do that. So, all right. So, you're majoring in aerospace sciences, engineering. How did you do academically overall at West Point?
You know, I was a very average student. There was about 900 plus students in my graduating class out of about 1200 that started. And I ended up right around 500, was my, where I ranked out of those 900 plus. So I was right in the middle, and I also played, varsity sports when I was there, and that kept me pretty busy.
What
and
sport?
So I was just optimizing. I was a water polo player, grew up swimming and playing water polo when I was in California, carried into the collegiate level and played water polo all 4 years.
So, by the way, you mentioned Mike Pompeo. He is your year group from your area in California, and he's going through West Point as well. He became Secretary of State under Donald Trump, a congressman, CIA director, a bunch of other things, Harvard law grad. Were you friends with him during West Point?
Yeah, I knew Mike because he's from the local area. In fact, his parents and my parents were great friends. And when we were competing, you know, we were competing with each other to get into West Point. We just so happened to both be selected among others. You know, it's important, I think, to mention this when we talk about a leadership factory and name recognition of people that we know. There was a book written called The Long Gray Line several years ago. And I read this book as a captain. Long Gray Line is a nickname for West Point. And what I realized is West Point doesn't just produce leaders for the military. You know, the idea might be all these West Pointers grow up and become generals. It's not true. What it does is it produces leaders for the nation across the society. And this book showed that what West Point does is produce leaders, not just for the military, but, you know, in government and civilian corporations and in the legal community. And you know, just take class of 86, the class I graduated with. These are names people would know. Mike Pompeo, like you said, Secretary of State. Mark Esper was the Secretary of Defense. Mark Green is a congressman from my class. Joe DePinto is the CEO of 7-Eleven. Steve Cannon is the CEO of A&B Group, Arthur Blank's Foundation, and the CEO of the Atlanta Falcons. Joe Martin is the Vice Chief of Staff of the United States Army today as a four-star. So it produces leaders across society. And so the service to the nation goes beyond just the military, I think.
That's incredible. That really is cool. And so Mike Pompeo, didn't he graduate number one, back to him, didn't he graduate number one in terms of leadership and academics?
Yeah, he was the number one grad in the class. And that's always a highly esteemed position, requires incredible amount of talent and work. And we were very proud of him. And it's interesting and watch him go on. He later went to Harvard, became the editor of Harvard Law Review. He started his own aerospace company and with some of his classmates, frankly, in down in Wichita. And then, like you said, became a congressman, director of CIA and secretary of state. And so the talent at the top of a class like that isn't a one-off. This is something where, you know, when you're at the top of class at West Point, you're going to do things for the nation.
So just if you can boil it down, you know, leadership, we talked about it, you know, broadly, but like, what does West Point equip you to do? What does it teach you about leadership that most people don't know? Is there a secret to leadership? Can it be summed up?
Well, let me describe it a little bit for a minute. The first thing I learned about at West Point is that leadership does not equate to management. And since that I first learned that, I will tell you, I continue to learn about leadership every single day. I've told younger officers when I've spoken to them is that I believe that leadership is the most profound, impactful profession that one never masters. Think about that for a minute. The most profound, impactful profession that one never masters. And the reason is that a lot of other professions, you know, finance, science, engineering, programming, you know, has certain finite principles. But leadership specifically is dealing. What is leadership? It is most humbling because what you're seeking to do is to reach into a person's soul and lift them to a place they otherwise wouldn't be, but for your leadership. Which takes on. I said you reach into their soul. It's about a human relationship. What motivates each and every person? And every person has a different soul. Every person is motivated differently. And the challenge of the leader is to know so well his people, the individuals that work for them, that you understand their motivations so that you can draw them to a place that they otherwise wouldn't go. Why does West Point and the military particularly need to focus on leadership? Because it's the ultimate cost to where you're drawing them. That could be to their death, right? So that is a very sobering responsibility when your job is to draw them to a place they otherwise wouldn't go, but for your leadership when the outcome could be terminal. So I've found that every year of my life, I'm learning more and more about leadership, and you never master it because you're leading larger and larger organizations over time.
Okay, let's face it. And all that stuff is, what you just said is brilliant, of course, and very powerful. But I want to put this to you. There are a lot of people out there, more probably than ever before, who just don't want to be led. I mean, everybody, you know, can be a superstar now. You know, I can look like something I'm not on Instagram. I can be this. I can be that. I'm my own brand. I'm my brand. You know, I'm out to burnish my reputation. I don't want to be led around. Now, I think that ridiculous mindset that I just summarized probably has been there to some extent, but now with social media and other things, the independent streak is kind of taken off. And I don't know. I mean, there are more people than ever before who don't want to be led. Let me run that by you. And also, you know, so much of life in the military and in corporate America has been kind of bureaucratized and ritualized and written down, and there are procedures for everything. Is there enough room for leadership? Leadership sounds like an art, and it seems like we're taking the art out of everything.
It is. I think, actually, Greg, you're reinforcing my point. You know, those who don't want to be led make leadership all the more difficult, right? And then when we encumber institutions with the bureaucratic processes that you describe, it boxes out the great opportunity that leadership creates. That, you know, there are certain leaders in our history that could never survive a career in the United States military today. Profound leaders, leaders that were powerful in their impact, MacArthur's, Patton's. You could make a case that in today's era and today's culture, that the approaches that some of our historic leaders took would not be acceptable in a social media 24/7 news cycle environment where the costs are so high. And therefore, leadership, true leadership, requires great courage, given the advancements in technology and our changes in our culture today.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've heard that, like, MacArthur wouldn't have made it out of West Point. I mean, the stuff that he did, and the, you know, and Patton and all these guys, it's wild. So, all right. Next up for you, you get out of West Point. What was your first job?
You know, the first thing I did is you go to some training, officer basic training, and then I went to Ranger School down at Fort Benning. And then my first real assignment in a leadership position was to lead an armor platoon in Germany. And recall, this is spring of 87. The wall had not fallen yet. You still have a Soviet Union. There's still a significant border. And the deterrence mission was the primary purpose of those four deployed divisions.
Right, wait, going back to Ranger School, was that like hell on earth, or what was that all about?
That was the hardest thing I have ever had to do in my life. It was at the time it was about a 60-day program where you learn small unit patrolling tactics. It is an environment where you are getting very little sleep, maybe 2 to 3 hours of sleep a night, very little food, and every single day you're conducting missions and you rotate leadership positions where you are moving small units through very difficult, rigorous operations while employing the small unit leadership techniques that you're taught during the school. Very, very rigorous program.
So, yeah, we've heard about it. That does sound really intense. Now, you make it to... What is life like day in and day out when you're running an armor unit in then West Germany? I mean, is it like you're not in the woods all the time? I mean, this becomes fairly routine, right? I mean, you have a home. Are you married, by the way? Did you get married?
I did. I got married in 1989. When I took my first platoon, I was not married yet, so I was single. So I was able to pour myself into this new profession that I was entering. To answer your question, I chose to liken the role of a platoon leader training an armor platoon to that of a football coach. You know, when you're a football coach, there are a number of things and skills that you have to train at the lowest level. You know, you got to train blocking techniques. You got to make sure your runners are moving fast. You got to practice receiving. But at some point, you start to bring these skill sets together and synchronize them so the organization works then as a team, employing all the individual skills appropriately. So in the case of an armor platoon, you had to be, you know, first of all, you had to conduct maintenance and make sure your horses were in great shape. The second thing is you got to learn how to gunnery. You need to how to shoot those things. You need to learn how to maneuver. That is, what tactics are you using?
Armor, by the way, is tanks, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
And did you say horses? Were you being metaphorical, or what horses?
Metaphorical. You know, the origins of the armor and cavalry branch goes back to horse mounted cavalry. And we essentially grafted tanks into the Armored Cavalry branch. All of the leaders, you know, Patton was a cavalryman. He rode horses. In fact, he broke his leg on a horse. The first contribution to the United States Army of significance was designing a saber. So, but it was Patton who said, you know, with the automotive revolution, we probably should consider a mobile vehicle that's armored in lieu of the horse. And so all of that, that new technology was grafted into the cavalry branch. So yes, you got to take care of your horses.
You're in charge of how many guys, how many soldiers?
A tank platoon had 16 people in it. If you were a ground infantryman, you would have 30. So I had 16 non-commissioned officers and soldiers in my organization.
And you knew how to, you knew you were in a tank? Like if you went to combat, you'd be in a tank?
That's right. So there are four tanks in a 16-man tank platoon, four people per tank. One of those tanks was mine. And that's an interesting experience itself because you're the new guy. I oftentimes say, and you probably experience this, being a second lieutenant in the military is probably one of the most awkward ranks because you have, of the people that you lead, you have the most authority and the least amount of experience. And so there is a real balance between leveraging authority and having the humility to listen and learn at the same time. I think it's a fascinating, you know this, it's a fascinating dilemma that you put a leader into.
Yeah, I can't quite, I never really, I don't know, I think a lot of people blow it, quite frankly. I think they show a little bit too much humility. They can be owned by the enlisted pretty early on. They're tested, aren't they? So again, for the people,
that's
like,
right.
You're going in, you're the executive, you're in charge, but you've only been basically on the job for 3 weeks and you're with guys who have been on the job for 4 years. How do you justify that, by the way? I'm not quarreling with that system. I know the system. I understand the system. I like the system. But how do you defend that? Like, to an outsider, like, why would you take the least experienced guy and make him in charge?
Well, what we do with commissioned officers, first of all, there's a difference between being a commissioned officer and enlisted or non-commissioned. You know this, but you know, being a commissioned officer, you are your authority extends all the way up to the commander in chief. Unlike that of, you know, an enlisted soldier that goes in. And so you are the steward of that which comes from our civilian authorities. And to build somebody like that, and what we do is we say, you know what, we need to give them a different experience and a different education. And it's that broad liberal college education that enables us to start to invest in the skills and the thinking necessary to be that steward to the National Command Authority. We don't necessarily invest all of those kind of resources. I went to a 4-year academy education at the time was worth, I think, about $220,000 at the time, back in the 1980s. That's a lot of money to invest in resources and time to invest into a steward for the National Command Authority. We can't do that for everybody. So there's at a certain point, there's an entry point where there is an awkward dilemma, but the bet is, the view is that because of the amount of resources we put into you over the last 4 years to prepare you to become a lieutenant, gives you the wisdom to very rapidly integrate the technical skills that you might not have that your soldiers do.
Yes, sure.
So, and it's worked for years, I think. But you brought up a point, Greg. There are a lot of people that might struggle with this. We all struggle with it. But if you're too humble, you're going to allow yourself, like you said, to be owned by your organization and you aren't a proper steward. If you are overly arrogant, you're going to isolate yourself and you're not going to have the empowerment that you need. I see you're conducting leadership yourself. We've got a little one.
Did you hear that? Sorry.
It's all right.
So being inside a tank, what's the longest you've ever been in a tank? It's very, very cramped. I've never been in one. I've looked inside one. I can't imagine what life is like in there. It looks a little bit like the Apollo command module, but like not as spacious. It just seems like it's not fit for human beings. It's like you're inside a machine. It's like you're inside a machine and you look for places to sit inside a machine.
That's right. And it's very unforgiving because there's a 120 millimeter cannon that's right next to my left knee when I was a tank commander that you have to stay out of the way of because there's an incredible recoil on that thing. So they're very unforgiving machines. Back to your point on space, you know, most people, when they maybe have seen a movie or two about, you know, you might get the impression that it's a Winnebago inside. It's anything but that. If you think about a tank, the driver is not with the other three. The driver is up front in the vehicle in the hole. You can talk to him on an intercom, but you're not exposed to him. The tank commander sits a bit high to the right of a gun, and then right at my knees is the gunner, the one who has a primary role of engaging targets. To my left, on the other side of that 120 millimeter gun that I talked to you about, is a loader. He's the one throwing rounds into the thing. So you're talking about a 3 to 4 square foot area where people are thrust together to synchronize their efforts to optimize that tank.
And you got to coordinate with other tanks.
That's right.
It's very hard. It sounds like it's really
so you're difficult. Coordinating your own crew, you're coordinating your tank platoon. And as you go up an echelon, when I was a tank company commander, we had 14 tanks. So now you got more. And now you're not only synchronizing the efforts of your 14, but those on your left and on your right, two other tank companies. So it gets to get more and more complex as you move up an echelon.
What tank was it? The M1?
M1. A1 Abrams was what I had when I was a lieutenant.
And it was brand new at the time, right?
Brand new. In fact, when my first platoon, I missed this. It was an M60A3 for about 6 months or so. We turned in the old M60A3, the old patent tank, and we drew this brand new, very capable tank and went through the transition process of that.
So, by the way, the tank, like, how much of your time is actually spent on in the tank and on tactics and doing things like maneuvering and firing and all that stuff? And how much of your time is spent on administrative, evaluating people, paperwork, someone got in trouble, more paperwork? What's the breakdown, would you say?
Oh, golly. I think that more than 50% of the time, probably 60, 70% of the time, you're actually not in a tank. But again, it goes back to the role of the football coach. How many hours a day does he spend on the gridiron relative to throughout the year? He's doing a lot. He's doing recruiting. He's taking care of soldiers. Or rather, players. He's negotiating contracts. So I would say greater than 50% of the time, you're doing more administrative things, everything from processing maintenance paperwork to taking care of soldiers' awards, soldiers' personnel issues, discipline actions, planning. So there is 60-40 is probably a fair.
And frustration? Was that a frustration? The rumor has it that other militaries don't burden their soldiers and their leaders with as much administrative functions as we do. The Marine Corps, for instance, the Marine Corps has, there's one, maybe it's the same in the Army, but there's only one box on your evaluation form for a pilot for how well they do with airplanes. And there are like 50 boxes. Only one was about how you handled your airplane. Everything else was about, is it like that in the Army as well?
I think so, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. The beauty of the design of the military institution is the leader is responsible for everything about relative to his soldiers. It's not like as a lieutenant, I send my private to go see HR. That's absolutely wrong, right? True leadership is you are investing into the lives of these young men and women. And the military is one of those unique institutions where you truly have a role in influencing every aspect of a soldier's life from in one manner or another. You know, you're responsible for their spiritual welfare, their personal welfare, their financial welfare, their judicial issues, you know, because you have responsibility for the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That's not a bad thing. It can be frustrating at times because if you join the Army, you don't want to do paperwork. But it's about taking care of the personal issues of those soldiers. And when you can take care of the personal issues of those soldiers, now that there's a relationship there, And now you can start to have the impact I talked about earlier about reaching into somebody's soul and bringing them to a place they otherwise wouldn't, because you've earned credibility, because you care and love for them.
So right? Yep, absolutely. And so you're moving up the ranks. Life is good. Where did you go after Germany?
There's the military has a thing called continuing education. And so between assignments, oftentimes you'll go to school again. So I spent 4 to 6 months at Fort Knox, Kentucky, learning to be a company commander and a captain level staff officer. So went to Fort Knox, Kentucky for a short period. And then we went to the old cavalry post at Fort Riley, Kansas, where the 1st Infantry Division is headquartered. And it was in that time period that I was able to serve as a company commander.
And you're loving life. You're enjoying all of it.
Yes. And by that time I had been married, met my wife in Germany. She had been traveling there to visit a brother. She's a school teacher. She was a military brat, with an affectionate term, a military brat. Right. And her father had been a 30-year infantry colonel. And we were married, like I said, in 1989. So we moved together to Fort Riley, Kansas, to take on this new leadership role as a company commander.
And you have kids. How many?
We have 3 kids. They're all out of the house and moving on with their own careers now. But we had our first child was born there at Fort Riley, Kansas, Tyler. And that was back in 1991.
And did any of them go into the Army?
Our middle son, Austin, is a 35 Foxtrot. It's the nomenclature for an intel analyst in the reserves. And he's going through training now to improve his coding and cyber capabilities to enhance his talent as an intel analyst.
And you mentioned military brat. Now it is an affectionate term. We call ourselves that, although I wasn't a military brat, but I know about that. And you move from base to base to base every 3 years, sometimes less, sometimes more. So when people ask where you're from, you know, it's not an easy question to answer. And
right.
It seems to me that this story has not been told nearly adequately enough. Moving from school to school to school, I did it once in the 2nd grade, and I'm still I'm still in therapy. I mean, yeah, I just like, and that this happens. And I think that the kids of the military really pay a very, very, very big price. And there are some great benefits as well. I don't know. I wonder about that. You've been exposed to it, not just your own kids, other kids. And, you know, we ask a lot of the children of military personnel.
It's a massive ask of military kids because, frankly, we didn't ask them, right? It was thrust upon them. And I think what you said is very important. It's a story that hasn't been told. The military family is one of the most amazing stories about military culture and about our nation. And frankly, unique to our nation, because, you know, you take the UK, for example, most of those families don't move around. The family stays in one spot and he might move around a very small country like the UK. But the United States role worldwide and a nation as large as ours, you don't end up staying in one spot for more than 2 to 3 years. So let's talk about, you know, military kids. I will tell you, I grew up in Southern California, as I mentioned earlier, in one home the overwhelming majority of my life. And as I was going to West Point, a place I truly believed in and want to be a part of, I was not convinced at the time that I wanted to impose that on my family. And I remember saying to some of my peers when I went away to West Point is, well, I'm going to be in the Army, but when I have a family, I won't, because I wouldn't want to do that to my kids, right? Well, things obviously changed. You know what changed it, Craig? I dated a girl when I was at West Point, and then later my wife, same story. And I asked about that. I said, hey, you know, what was it like growing up in the Army? I mean, I don't know if that's a good thing. And both of them, a girl that I dated and a woman that became my wife, sort of looked at me like I had, you know, 3 eyes in my forehead, because what they said was, well, this is all I know. You know, this is the life I grew up with. And what I've come to believe is that what it really does is, number one, it binds the family, because your real roots, your handrail in a military family is your family. And that has some positive aspects to it. Siblings draw very close to one another. So that's point number one. The other thing is, though, that military kids learn how to relate and make friends in ways that maybe you and I didn't, because we were so stable. We weren't forced into a position to make friends, which you could say is that's pretty heavy pressure to put on a young kid. But I'll tell you what, when they go away to college, they got it down. And then the third thing I would mention, if I don't not, hope I'm not going on too long here, is kids of military families have a much, my view, because I was not a military kid, and I compare my kids to what I grew up with, they have a much broader perspective, a much broader worldview. You know, when my son is 9 and he's asking me about, you know, Saddam Hussein and his role in, you know, in Iraq at the time prior to the war, those are questions, insightful questions that you might not get from a young man whose dad is not thrust into a campaign against Saddam Hussein. My son, I remember after 9/11, very quickly memorized the names of every single terrorist on those aircraft on that fateful day. So the exposure to a worldview, I think, it allows them to mature in ways that others in a very lucrative nation like the United States, who have become very accustomed to the comforts that we've grown up with. I will tell you, military kids have a little bit broader view and a little bit greater understanding of the world they're going into.
Yeah.
There's a cost. There's a cost, though.
Big time. I've seen it. I've seen kids who have flourished, and I've seen, and it's an untold story to be continued on that front. Look, let me ask you this, though. You mentioned in Britain they stay in one place. You also mentioned the school you went to. Now there are schools in the military, and I don't think people appreciate this, or maybe they do, when you go to a school, not the schools you went to, those sound like pretty hardcore schools, but there are some schools in the military, it's like almost like tantamount to taking a year off. It's like taking a vacation. You know, I'm going to go to this school, I'm going to take it easy, I'm going to be a fellow at the United Nations, it's a year away from your primary mission. And what am I getting at? I feel like potentially there are so many kind of other things to do in the military. We create these very well-rounded officers who know a little bit about everything, which there's an advantage to that. But you know, the mastery of just one thing, and I think that going back to China, that their military is more invested in, learn this thing, know this thing, and spend 20 years doing it. We're not taking you out to send you to public affairs school for 6 weeks, even because you're not a public affairs officer. You're an infantry officer, and that's what you're going to spend all your time doing. We make a lot of deviations. Is it time to reevaluate that? And maybe you can explain, or you can disagree with me, but it seems like we spend a lot of time and money kind of taking our eye off the ball, arguably.
Yeah, so this is always a dilemma, and it's a constant debate. I would say that there is great purpose in having a broad liberal development, a broad liberal education for the purpose of a leader. But as you also are pointing out, there are some highly technical capabilities that we want certain people to have. And I think that for example, there are some militaries that say, okay, if you're going to be a leader, we're going to stick with the more broader development that occurs. If you're going to be a specialist in a certain area, you're not going to be a leader, but you're going to be really good at this technical capability. And I think there's room for both. But I would argue that for your leaders, those are going to go up to senior executive levels. This broad education has great merit, because we don't want, what is a general officer doing? He is employing policy on behalf of the National Command Authority and integrates with a lot of different institutions and across the interagency. Let me give you an example. Now, this was not an easy one, Greg, but I worked in the White House for 2 years. I learned more about the behaviors of the interagency, Washington, D.C., politics, budgeting, and resources, and prioritization across within the Capitol, than I would have ever learned in any book or any articles that I might read, etc. Fascinating understanding of how our government works. That I was able to use that and leverage that as a leader later on. And had I not done that, I wouldn't have known the different cultures of the Justice Department or the State Department, as it were. And that was indispensable.
By the way, I think a general officer, you know, General MacArthur, General Wesley, general comes from generalist, right? You know a lot about a lot of things. Isn't that where, or I'm guessing.
That's exactly right. And, you know, one of the jokes we say about West Point is West Pointers can talk for 5 minutes about anything. But it's not designed necessarily to make me a physicist. It's designed to, remember, what am I doing? We're reaching into different souls and across a very large institution, and you're wanting to move them towards a vision, a strategy that you are employing. And so knowing the different cultures, different behaviors, different motivations is critical to making that machine operate effectively.
So when people go back and look at your fitness reports, like, what was the key to your success in the military, would you say? You went to the very, very top. You worked for a lot of different people. Was there one thing about you that your superiors noticed and documented and wrote about or told you? Was there a key to your success? And that, probably not. It's probably all of the, you know, everything we've been talking about. But is there one thing that kept coming up that you were doing well?
You should ask my mother this question, Greg. This is an awkward question to ask someone. I don't know. I probably am a good mix between my father and my mother. My mother's a good communicator, interacts with people a lot. My dad was an engineer. I did have a certain experience that I was happy about. I told you I was an aerospace engineer at West Point. And then by the time I got out of West Point, I realized, you know what, you're not an engineer, brother. And so I moved more towards social sciences, international relations, national security policy, and that I really enjoyed. My father apologized for it. He said, I'm sorry, I imposed that engineering on you. And I said, no, it's good, because as an aerospace engineer, I learned how to think in frameworks and logic. And yet I was then able to employ more social or policy oriented things into a framework that allowed, you know, it worked at larger levels. But I don't know, Greg, I just used to chop wood that was in front of me, and whatever job I was in, I wanted to make the most of it. And I never dreamed I would be a battalion commander, much less go to the level of general officer. I was blessed. But there's also, look, Greg, there's luck involved too. There's a lot of luck involved. There are some brilliant people that have, for whatever reason, not been promoted. I was lucky to work for really good people. You know one of them. Dave Perkins, that you and I both served with, was just a fascinating thinker, a great communicator, and we got along very, very well. And when you have relationships with people that are senior to you, you have advantages that maybe someone else didn't. So luck is a good part of it too, Greg.
When you say luck, is part of luck like that nothing went wrong, there was no accident on your watch? Now, for instance, Colin Powell in his autobiography, he lost a gun. He lost a pistol when he was in Vietnam. And the guy he was working for, you know, kind of gave him a slap on the wrist, a talking to. It was not documented. It could have been documented, and it could have been a really bad thing for him. I think they found the weapon ultimately. If you lose a weapon in the military, you know, that can't be brushed over, I don't think, and probably shouldn't be either. But anyway, he talked about zero defects mentality, and the military has that. And sometimes things happen beyond your control. When you say luck, is that part of the luck? I know you mentioned you work for some great people, but, you know, something can go wrong on anybody's watch, no matter how good a leader, no matter how much attention to detail, and they're gonna blame somebody, and it usually is or often is the officer in charge.
That's right. And what we always say is, as a leader, there will be bad days. It's not if there will be bad days, there will be bad days. And I think the real DNA of a leader comes out and is defined by those bad moments. And it's, you're thrust into a position. What are you going to do in that situation? Not only the one that had the bad thing happen to them, but in the case of the Count Colin Powell example, he had a leader that was able to underwrite the mistake or error that his organization had. And so that's fortune right there, that if you work for a leader that can absorb a defect and not be draconianly employ a zero defects environment, that's fortune, right? So I think that all of these things come to play. Every one of us who have been in a leadership position have had a really bad day. And it's what really will define the outcome of that is you and how you react to it and the leaders over you. The degree to which they can underwrite it.
What can you give us an example of something, you know, something bad, one of those bad days where something went wrong?
And you I could give you
a million.
Yeah, I can give you countless. You know, I remember when as a company commander and had a suicide in my organization, which is just devastating. How do you respond to that? I can remember in combat losing soldiers who are carrying out instructions that you gave them. That's a very bad day. I will tell you one more recently when I commanded Fort Benning, Georgia, we had a very bad situation where a number of new recruits, female recruits who were then being integrated in the infantry and armor branches, endured a horrific experience of sexual assault by our drill sergeants. And I remember the chief of staff of the Army at the time, General Milley, came down to visit me. And I told him, I said, sure, you might have to relieve me. This is a bad thing. I just so happened that I had a commander or a chief at the time named General Mark Milley, who said, no, we're not going to do that. You just carry on, keep doing what you're doing. And we resolved the situation. It was very bad, but those are bad experiences, but you got to be ready to respond to them. And you know what? Here's the deal. It won't always work in your favor. One of the things I've oftentimes said, we ask young troops to expose themselves to enemy fire. And sometimes they don't come home. As a leader, you won't be quite as exposed to enemy fire as maybe statistically that your young enlisted men are. But we're willing to expose ourselves to professional fire. And sometimes the military has to relieve a commander in order to stop the bleeding, in order to make a fundamental change. And, you know, there are times when a leader will feel like that wasn't fair. But, you know, neither is taking a bullet in combat seem fair. So it's a risk. When you're a leader, you take risk. And sometimes there has to be a change.
You know, if you get relieved of command in 2021, 2020, or any time really in the past 50 years, that was it. Your career was over. Someone pointed out, I think it was maybe something I read in the Wall Street Journal 10 years ago, but that was not always the case. In World War II, you could be relieved, sent back to Washington, and you know, like basically re-educated and be deployed again. It wasn't the worst thing that could ever happen. It was, you know, a setback, and I think it happened to some very prominent generals. Perhaps that's something we should revisit as a military.
I think you're right. You know, what accounts for that? I think number one, we had a much bigger army in World War II and you had the flexibility to do some of that. So that's a point to be made. Secondly, you didn't quite have the media exposure of a relief. Now, today, if a general officer is relieved, it will definitely be in the news media that goes worldwide. That didn't happen in World War II. And then third, I think to some degree, this creeping of woke behavior, once you've been marked, you can never recover. And that part of it, I think, probably we need to be a little bit more resilient on. Human condition is such that none of us are perfect, right? And so if we want to eliminate 10, 20, 30 years of experience that was very costly for errors that are do occur in our society, I think we're not optimizing who we are as a resilient military. But those are questions that, you know, leaders have to make. And obviously we have civilian oversight that is fundamental. But I think we're working through some of those things.
Well, to be continued for sure, very soon. We didn't touch on so many other interesting and fascinating aspects of his life and career. We certainly will the next time. In the meantime, thank you so much for supporting the podcast. Drop us an email. Give me a follow on Twitter, if you don't mind, at Greg Kelly USA. Oh, and that's where you'll see a picture of Eric Wesley in battle, standing next to some guy named Greg Kelly. It's at the top of my Twitter. That's Eric. What a privilege to know a man of such integrity and excellence, really. Okay, folks, thank you, and we'll be back soon.